You build the world. The roads, schools and hospitals. That's your work. And we're with you on this journey. Procore, your trusted construction partner. Discover our construction management platform at procore.com.
It's Wednesday, the 21st of August, 2024, and this is Reconstruction with David Taylor and Phil Bishop from the Construction Index. Back from a summer break to talk about some of the stories that have broken over the past few weeks. Doesn't feel like a summer break, Phil. Feels more like autumn already, but still, it was quite nice to have a bit of time off.
I had a lovely sunny week away, and I'm sorry that anyone that missed us 2 weeks ago when we were supposed to be talking, but we decided we'd go on holiday instead. But
yeah, why not?
We're back now with a lot to catch up on. A lot's been happening.
I know, it's ridiculous, isn't it? I mean, August is supposed to be the slow month for news across the board, really, because everybody goes on holiday. But actually, no, you're right. Quite a lot has happened over the last couple of weeks. I think we've mentioned, haven't we, that we've got a new Labour government in place, just in case anybody wasn't aware of that. But there have been quite a few decisions made and events surrounding the incoming government, which are probably worth discussing here.
Well, absolutely, yeah. 50 days of Starmer, just about. Certainly this week, we see the 50 days. Normally talk about the first 100 days of a premiership or presidency being significant, but we're halfway into that. Yeah, there's been a lot of announcements. The King's speech was last month and setting out the legislative programme. And then events have happened to stop the Prime Minister going on holiday. There's appalling riots. But I think one thing to say about Starmer is he seems to have handled that situation pretty competently, as you'd expect from a former director of public prosecutions. Some of the sentences handing down to the trolls, I mean, I think there's a difference. Maybe there isn't, but I see a difference between people actually going out and rioting and people just sitting at home writing snarky things on their social medias. But maybe, you know, maybe it's time to treat trolling as a badder crime as actually physical rioting rather than mental
excitement.
Rioting.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. Yeah, absolutely. No, I was quite surprised how decisively he came down on those rioters. I suppose he needed to nip it in the bud before chaos broke out all over our urban areas. But no, I thought that was handled very deftly, actually. And I'd like to see more quick solutions to things like that. I did find it a little bit difficult to reconcile the speed with which he dealt with these issues with the way the legal system normally works, because as I think we've mentioned previously, some cases take years to come to court. Serious cases that really shouldn't be held up, people waiting to be sentenced or even tried and found guilty or innocent, being held up for years. But no, he managed to push this through and even managed to find some more prison space, which was quite remarkable. So when you need to do things, you can usually find a way.
I think there might be chickens coming home to roost on a lot of the early releases, though. There'll be newspaper journalists tailing all these released criminals, waiting for them to reoffend, going, ha, they let him out earlier and they've gone and done it again.
Exactly.
That's a high-risk strategy. But it's got no choice until he starts building more prisons, which, I mean, they've talked about doing that. They've talked about doing a lot. I mean, okay, let's get back to topic, construction.
Yeah.
I think we talked in a previous podcast, certainly it was in the Labour Party manifesto, that they were going to be builders, not blockers, and it's all about planning reform and get house building going. And they set this 300,000 new homes in 5 years of Parliament target. Now it's gone up to
1.5 million new homes, isn't it?
I beg your pardon, I think of a year, yes. 1.5 during you're absolutely right. 370. It's now going up to 370,000 a year, they're now saying.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, it sounds great, and everyone in the construction, in the house building, certainly is going, yep, great. And they say they're going to relax the Greenbelt restrictions. There's going to be a presumption of giving permission to anything on a on brownfield sites. New town commission's been set up to identify within a year locations for a raft of new towns. Bam. And it all sounds great, but we've been here before. I mean, the point is, government doesn't build houses, except possibly, you know, accommodation.
Council houses, yeah.
Well, no, it doesn't even build council houses. The government does. It's local authorities. All the government builds.
Well, okay.
Housing for prisoners and housing for the military. And I can't think of much else that the government provides accommodation for. And local authorities are still severely constrained about what they can do with their receipts and how, you know, how much money they can spend on house building. So there's not going to be a huge upswing, I don't think, in public sector building. So they're basically looking to the private sector. They're saying, we will make it easier for you. Please build more houses. So it's all very well the government setting targets. It's up to the market whether it's actually going to happen, which is exactly where we've seen, you know, under the previous government. I mean, they had this huge drive and they're going to do, you know, investing in putting our money into prefab builders who subsequently go bust, to try, you know, the speed up offsite construction to get lots of cheap and chatty houses up there quickly. And it didn't work for the Tories. And okay, they reined back on the setting targets for local authorities, which the Labour government have now said that they're going to reintroduce, that local authorities must have targets and aren't allowed to let local interest override the national need for more housing, which is, yeah, a lot of people think, well, yep, that's necessary. Let's, you know, block the NIMBYs.
Yeah.
But I've talked before about the importance of democracy, and local democracy is important. And if the people of Suffolk, for example, don't want a nuclear power station, I feel it's a bit rough on them being told you're having it. Similarly, if people in you know, a little village somewhere in the Cotswolds are suddenly being told, well, you may have a lovely village, but it's so lovely, we're going to build lots and lots more houses there, and you're going to have a new town on your doorstep. I think it's, you know, there is a national need, but there's also, you know, there is such a thing as local democracy, which I think is important.
But then, you know, people living and working on the route of HS2, for example, they don't get that opportunity. They're told that, you know, we're going to compulsorily purchase your property and you've got to move out somewhere else because we're going to build a railway going right through your land or through your house, whatever it is. So, I mean, it's not as if we aren't used to people being foisted with these nationally important projects.
Of course, omelette and eggs and all of that. But at least with HS2, there was parliamentary legislation. It went through parliament and it took ages, years and years of planning, lots of argument, and there was an awful lot of due process. Now, if we're going to go through an HS2 kind of process for building new towns, Keir Starmer will not be Prime Minister when they actually start construction. They'll be 30 years away.
Yeah. That's true. But then this whole, because Angela Rayner, the Deputy Prime Minister, she's also the Housing Secretary, isn't she? She set up this new towns task force to identify sites. But the Tory government did the same thing, didn't they?
Yeah.
We've talked about, you know, identifying sites for new towns, and I don't know how many of them have been built so far. I mean, there have been some big developments on the edge of existing towns, but I mean, actual new towns like Milton Keynes or Harlow or places like that, you know, I can't see anything like that being built.
Well, there's, I mean, Ebbsfleet, this goes back to when Heseltine, so the what was called the Thames Corridor, the East Thames Corridor, Ebbsfleet in North Kent. There has been a lot of house building, but it is not yet the brave new world. There's not yet Milton Keynes there, which they're supposed to have been by now. I mean, it's been steady, but it's been very slow. And that's all, of course, that was all predicated on there being an Ebbsfleet International Railway Station, which station's still there, but there aren't even international stations there. All the growth that Ashford had on the back of the Ashford International Station, you cannot get a train from Ashford to Paris anymore. They don't, you know, that doesn't exist. And so this brings me on to what I think the government really needs to get a handle on, which I don't think they've talked about yet, is the importance of having the infrastructure before the housing. It's all very well saying we're going to build a new town, but unless the infrastructure is there and you commit to the infrastructure, it won't work. Now, often the best way, a lot of the biggest developments you've seen on the edge of towns, market towns, for example, is when a town has a bypass. And I can think of, for example, Burley and Wharfdale near Ilkley in West Yorkshire. Lovely town, had a bypass. Great. And then between the actual small town, village, and the bypass, lots and lots and lots of new build housing went in. This is going back 20 years or something like that. And so building a bypass, building a road, it creates an area, a development site for house building. And it becomes, broadly speaking, win-win. The village becomes bigger but nicer, or the town becomes bigger but nicer by having the traffic moved out of it. And the Arundel bypass, for example, I'm sure the people of Arundel don't want more house building around there, but the Arundel bypass has been cancelled. And I think there actually needs to be a programme of bypass building in conjunction with house building, and maybe not just that, but also public transport, which is then maintained. But they're not going to restart the HS2 Northern leg. I don't think they're not going to look at that. I mean,
hardly.
Yeah. I mean, Rachel Reeves, the Chancellor, has made it clear she doesn't want to spend any money on anything apart from pay rises to public sector workers. And so we've had the Stonehenge tunnel cancelled. Now, that's controversial, but it's been cancelled, not on environmental grounds, because it's only a few days before the Chancellor scrapped that programme that government officials were arguing with UNESCO that it's a perfectly fine, lovely project, because UNESCO were threatening to remove the Stonehenge's status as a World Heritage Site because of the threat of the road building. And government officials go, no, it's a beautiful project. It's fine. It's not going to do any damage. It's going to be great. It's going to actually help preserve the World Heritage Site by taking traffic out of it and sticking it underground. All going to be fabulous. Mm. So that is clearly not the motive. It's purely that they don't think it's good value for money.
They don't want to spend the money.
They don't want to spend the money.
But they don't want to spend the money.
If the government cannot look to house builders, the private sector house builders, and say, build houses, build houses, build houses. If the government is not prepared to stump it, put its hand in its pocket and build the infrastructure that is needed to make the housing viable, attractive, and not ruin towns like where I live in Maidstone, it's completely clogged up with traffic because we've had, 20% housing growth or more in the past 10, 15 years, and no road building, and you can't get anywhere.
No. I think that's a good point to stress, actually, is the connection between house building and infrastructure, because, the talk has tended to be, that the government is going to try and encourage more house building, but it's cutting back on infrastructure spending. And the two cannot be separated, can they? Because they're interdependent, in other words. As you say, the reason why they're doing that is, because as you've pointed out, they don't have to spend the money to build the houses because the private sector will do that. But they do have to spend the money to fund infrastructure projects, and they don't want to spend the money. And it's strange. I mean, traditionally, the Labour Party has been the party of tax and spend, hasn't it? And we've been told by, the new Chancellor that she doesn't want to raise taxes, although she's probably going to. No new taxes was Keir Starmer's sort of rallying cry before the general election. And he's not going to raise taxes, but he's not going to spend anything on infrastructure either. So really, this isn't the sort of thing you normally expect from a Labour government. You'd expect them to increase taxes, certainly for the higher earners, and spend that money on public projects.
They're supposed to be Keynesians. They're supposed to be recognised. I mean, you only need to look at Crossrail, the Elizabeth line. Yes, it was late and it was over budget and this, that and the other. But the finished project, as we talked before, the station developments the developments around the stations of the whole length of Crossrail, of the Elizabeth line, has enabled masses of development all over the place. And that's what I'm talking about, not just roads, but railway lines which enable housing development, be that social or private sector, you've got to get the infrastructure there first. And then it becomes so much easier and so much more marketable, both financially and politically, to put the housing in.
Yeah. Well, what's the industry saying about this? I imagine that the people at the House Builders Federation are fairly pleased about it. What about, you know, the Civil Engineering Contractors Association, people like that? Have they got much to say about this?
I think the Civil Engineering Contractors Association have been fairly stum, actually. I haven't heard much from them. Mm. Most of what you hear is supportive, broadly predictable. Certainly the big house builders, with the relaxation of planning constraints, going, great, there's music to our ears, this is just what we want, thank goodness, this is great news. The smaller house builders, some of them saying, but don't forget about us, we're the people that can really make a difference. More, I think the smarter people are going, yeah, this is all well and good, but we don't have the builders. we don't have the workforce to build
the skills,
370,000 houses a year. Never mind, we have the market to buy it and to make it all happen, to make it work. But the supply chain is not there, particularly post Brexit. And one of the things that Starmer's saying about that is he's going to set up a new, what's it called, a new skills task force. I've got it somewhere, but I can't find it immediately. But the Skills England, some new agency, okay, which is going to bring together and it's particularly focused on construction, to say that we're going to create a domestic workforce rather than rely on imported labour, as we've had to do in the past. But as we've talked about before, the construction leadership people, some of these big companies who wrote that ridiculous lobbying document, say we need to be able to not only import our cheap labour from overseas, we need to import people from overseas to train British workers, because we not only can we not build things, we can't even train people to build things, they were saying. So I'm not quite sure how quickly we can sort that one out. And we're going to move on to talk later this morning about an organisation that was doing good work in tackling the skills shortage, which has disappeared. So I think there are huge question marks about the capacity of the construction industry to do any better than it's doing, frankly.
Yeah.
I just want to talk about one other thing on the subject of infrastructure we're talking about, cancelling roads. Okay. There's now been, although Rachel Reeve said, I'm clamping down on the use of outside consultants, we spend far too much on consultants in Whitehall. One of the first things she did was get the Department of Transport to bring in consultants to review the rest of the roads programme to see what else could be axed. One thing which hasn't been axed yet, and I don't think will be, is the Lower Thames Crossing. The reason why that won't be axed is because there is a commitment with the Lower Thames Crossing that it will be tolled. There will be a revenue stream, which was never suggested for the Stonehenge Tunnel. Could have been, wasn't. The reason why there will be, can be, maybe has to be, tolls on the Lower Thames Crossing is because it's basically a mirror for the Dartford Crossing. It used to be that the easternmost crossing of the Thames was Blackwall Tunnel. Then they built the Dartford Tunnel, Dartford Bridge, put tolls on that. We've now got tolls on the, haven't used the Blackwall Crossing for years, but I think that's tolled, the Blackwall Tunnel. So the Lower Thames Crossing, further east than Dartford, that will have tolls on it, which are presumably at the same level as the Dartford tolls, which are £2.50 for a car, £6 for a lorry. So I think it would be quite easy for the Department for Transport to say, we're taking away the Lower Thames Crossing from national highways because we don't want to pay for it, and we're going to stick that into, just as the Dartford Bridge was built by Trafalgar House and they were given 20 years or 25 years or whatever it is of tolls, which was supposed to go in 2003, but here we are, we've still got the tolls on the Dartford Bridge, which now go to the Treasury. I think there's scope to very easily do a, I mean, people think the PFI is dead and buried, but PFI...
I was going to say.
it only needs to be dead and buried when you've got these bogus... we talked about this before, the revenue stream is bogus, like with hospitals and schools and prisons. I mean, it doesn't... Financially, it's a con. But when you've got a bridge or a tunnel where you say, pay me tuppence every time you cross and eventually you get your money back.
That's real money.
Yeah, and yeah. It works. And it's a little bit for every motorist. Okay, it could be quite a lot for a lot of motorists, but it works. And there's no reason not to do that for across estuarial crossings. That was always what the whole thing was born out of anyway, that and the Channel Tunnel. So if they can do that for the Lower Thames Crossing, why can't they toll the Stonehenge Tunnel? I think that...
Maybe because people would go up through Lark Hill. Everybody go up through Lark Hill, and I do that anyway if I see a big tailback ahead of me. They'll find other routes and they'll end up going through country lanes and small villages and just spreading the... You know,
well, they could
damage further.
They could leave the existing A303 route there for 20 years or until the tunnel's paid for. So people who don't want to pay for the tunnel, just like the Birmingham Northern Relief Road, if it's called, it's probably not called that anymore, but when it used to be the alternative,
the M6 toll. Yeah,
you could either pay your money and go the quick way, and that was. I haven't done that for ages, and it used to be absolutely fabulous. Not me, of course, but people I know knew that they didn't put any speed traps on there because they didn't want to discourage people from using it. So people I know, not me, would go on there and drive as fast as their car would let them because there'd be hardly any cars and really put their foot down and thought, wee, what fun. I never did that.
No, of course you didn't. That'd be quite unlike. So you reckon they could do that with Stonehenge? Well, it's too late now because they're not going to revive the project, are they?
Ha! Someone's going to revive it at some time. It's the current route. Well, as soon as we get another Prime Minister like David Cameron, who's got a house in Padstow or Rock or whatever, they'll reinstate it because it will eventually be the London Cornwall motorway. There has to be a London Cornwall motorway. Mm. Eventually.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I totally agree. I mean, it's been proposed for years and years and years, hasn't it? So it's just got so close, but didn't quite make it this time. So got to wait for another Tory government before we see that one. Well, as you say, one of the obstacles to all this is the chronic lack of skills in the industry. And you alluded a few minutes ago to... an organisation whose raison d'etre has been to encourage more people to join the industry, but which has folded due to a lack of support, certainly lack of money. Tell us a bit about that, because it came as quite a surprise to me.
The organisation you're talking about, David, is called Women into Construction, which has done an awful lot of good work over the past 16 years. Nearly 5,000 women they've supported, with 3,000 people have gone through training programs, 1,300 have completed work placements, and 1,300 women have gained employment in the construction industry over the past 16 years because of Women into Construction. Now, of course, in the grand scheme of things, 1,300 people out of the millions that work in the construction industry and the supply chain is a drop in the ocean, but it's an important drop and it's a starting point, and there are clearly... it's one of many organisations doing good work. Mm. But despite support from something like 350 companies and partnerships with local authorities and the government organisations and agencies and all sorts of organisations have been working with it to get women into taster sessions and trying out work on construction sites and so on and so forth, it seemed like... You'd think that there would be companies queuing up to support it, but apparently not. There were companies that had, you know, have given it support in the past, but they've run out of money. Which, it seems bizarre
because I mean, I still get emails on a regular basis from people talking about, you know, either it's employers or it's training organisations. Whoever, people in every sort of walk of life in the construction industry when they're doing something to do with engaging women, you know, school leavers, girls going into construction instead of hairdressing or something like that, they need to let us know about it. They're proud of it. And everybody acknowledges it's one of these things which is a sort of a no-brainer. There is only one view on this, that there aren't enough women in the construction industry. Now, you could argue with that, actually.
Well, there aren't enough men either.
Well, that's right. That's true. But no, it's one of those things. It's a bit like, maybe it's not as fashionable as it was, because I was going to say it's a bit like net zero. Everybody now, every chance they get to let people know about their carbon reduction programs and their, you know, their journey towards net zero, they never let, you know, they never let a stone be unturned. Is that the right phrase? But anyway, we all know about it. And it was the same with getting women and racial minorities into the construction industry, because, you know, we're chronically understaffed in the construction industry. And there's all those women out there doing jobs which don't benefit the industry. We need to lure them in, you know. And that's still the case, more than ever, probably. And yet there's no support for an organisation like Women Into Construction. I don't believe it.
I think, perhaps I change the subject, I think talking more generally about getting women into construction, part of the battle is that they might not like the idea, or they might perceive cultural obstacles to working on a big construction site.
Yeah.
But the message that could be sold to 15, 16-year-old women who are looking, girls who are thinking about, what am I going to do with my career, or even 30-year-old women looking to get back into the workplace after childcare or whatever, is that construction is not just B2B working for, you know, Lange Rort building a stadium or a power station or something. There's an awful lot of the B2C stuff, working in people's homes, doing, you know, as a plumber or fitting a cat flap, or electrician, rewiring at someone's home, painting and decorating, whatever. And the beauty of that self-employed lifestyle, if you've got the skills, is that you don't need to be particularly, you know, burly. It's not heavy, hard work. You can work as hard or as unhard as you want. What's the opposite of hard work?
Light.
The point I'm trying to get at is if you need to combine earning good money, working for yourself, mm-hmm. for the hours that you choose, with either childcare or old parent care or other sort of binds that a lot of women find themselves in, mm-hmm. with their domestic situations, more than men, unfairly, is that you can quite easily say, yeah, I'm a painter and decorator. I'll work afternoons. So I'm a plumber. I can't come on Tuesdays and Wednesdays, but I'm available other day. You know, you can, if you're self-employed, you can just say yes, no to whatever work, and there is a shortage of, you know, anyone who's trying to, I don't exaggerate, but an awful lot of people who are trying to, you know, find a plumber to change a washer on a tap, or any job that they can't, you know, find intimidating to themselves. There's a shortage out there.
Yeah, it's true.
And you can charge the earth.
Yes, absolutely. And there are many tradeswomen out there doing good work. A lot of them, you know, sort of market themselves as, you know, tradeswomen to a female audience. I mean, a lot of single women, for example, wouldn't want a strange bloke coming in and spending a day underneath her sink. You know, she'd much rather have a woman do that. And all right, then, I know that that's not going to be a massive marketplace for anybody in the plumbing or electricity or the electrician's trade. But there are plenty.
It's a sales point.
And there are women out there doing exactly as you describe. And the other thing is that there are plenty of women in white collar roles in the construction industry, which I think a lot of people don't really appreciate. There are some of the engineers and designers who worked on Crossrail, for example. We've written about that in the past. I mean, some really impressive people out there with incredible skills at achieving a great deal. I don't know if you remember, a couple of years ago, there was a sort of a documentary series on, I think it was BBC Four, it might have been Channel Four, I can't remember, but it was on terrestrial television anyway. I think it was called Brickies, and it followed a team of bricklayers, two of which were young women who were, you know, very fashion conscious, did all the sorts of things that, you know, 20-odd-year-old women do, had the same sort of interests, and yet they earned a living laying bricks, and they earned good money doing that. And they were great ambassadors for the trade. It's, you know, there are opportunities for women, and why can't we encourage more women to come into the construction industry and do them? We need all sorts of people in the construction industry.
Hello, David. I'm conscious that we're 260-something white blokes talking about diversities. It's not a good look.
And we don't work in the construction industry, to be honest.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, so yeah, I was surprised to see women into construction fold for lack of interest, which is strange.
It's shocking, actually,
it
I think.
Is. It is. Anything else to discuss?
Well, that's not the only collapse there's been. Company we've talked about again in the past, Hypertunnel.
Oh, yes.
I don't go and talk much about this because this is... I never quite believed it in the first place. And I thought, how can this ever work? And now it hasn't. But you've written more about Hypertunnel than I have, I think. What is Hypertunnel? You explain it, David.
Well, it's you're right, it's a very strange sort of concept. It's a completely different tunneling concept. You know, normally we're used to things like earth pressure balanced tunneling machines, the sort of things that build the, you know, the Channel Tunnel and Crossrail and stuff like that. That's the way we build tunnels, spend millions and millions and millions building this bespoke machine, which is about 200 meters long. But Hypertunnel had another idea. They decided they were going to use a swarm of bots to create a tunnel. And the idea is that what you do, you use horizontal direct drilling. I can barely say that, HDD. Drilling holes horizontally, only quite small holes, you know, a few centimeters in diameter, along the sort of outline of a tunnel. If you imagine a tunnel being essentially a sort of a cylinder, you would drill a series of holes. I'm pointing with my finger, but nobody else can see me. Along there. And then you send in these little holes that you've drilled along the sort of the outline of the tunnel, you then send in these little robots, a swarm of bots, which inject grout into the surrounding earth and soil. And that grout hardens, and that creates a sort of a carapace, a hard sort of, a bit like sprayed concrete, I suppose, only it's injected from inside. It's not injected from the outside into the soil. And that's enough to support the soil on the outside. And then you go in with traditional machines, mining machines, I suppose, and you dig out the soil inside. Yeah. It's much quicker, much safer, and much cheaper. And that was the idea. But it's this whole idea of a sort of an army of robot, you know, little sort of artificial robots sort of whizzing up and down these tunnels just seemed just too extreme, really, too advanced, you know, very sci-fi. But the funny thing was, and this is what I say, the funny thing was, it seemed strange at the time, is that this won the respect of some of the most highly respected people in the tunnelling industry. I mean, Mark Carney, wasn't he the former boss of Network Rail? Is it Network Rail, Mark Carney? Well, he became the boss of Hypertunnel.
When they first appeared, I want to say, well, the company I think was registered in about 2019, but I think it's 2021. They appeared at the British Tunnelling Society.
That's right.
Annual conference exhibition, and gave a presentation. And when I read about this proposal that you've talked about, I thought, this is sci-fi. This is Thunderbolt.
Yeah, absolutely.
It may happen in the future, but this is not going to happen now. And to my mind, it lacked credibility because neither of the two people behind it were in any way had anything to do with tunnelling or civil engineering, structural engineering. I think one was one of these sort of entrepreneurs who, I mean, it might have been a wealthy man, but it had an awful lot of sort of pop-up collapse businesses or pop-up disappear businesses, you know, one of these sort of ideas guys.
Yes.
Where it just seemed like, it just seemed flaky. And then, lo and behold, on the back of their presentation, British Tunnelling Society, all these top tunnelling experts, professors, whizzes, eminent people were saying, this is great. And they formed a board of consultants, or an advisory board, a technical board, with, I can't remember how many, it's at least a dozen eminent people, and got Mark Carney from Network Rail as their chairman. And you think, oh my God, if all these people think it's kosher, what do I know? It must be smart.
Exactly. Yeah. But and they got quite a long way. They did some trial tunnel bores, didn't they? I mean, I've never actually seen a finished hypertunnel tunnel. But when we wrote about this about, what, 2 years ago, maybe even 3 years ago, actually, they were already planning full-scale trials somewhere. Was it somewhere? They're based in Basingstoke. They were based in Basingstoke, so I think it was somewhere in Hampshire. So they were going to actually try. It wasn't just a paper exercise. They were going to actually do this for real.
But even quite recently, they got funding from from Vinci. Invested in them. So yeah, credibility there.
Yeah,
but it turned out that what happened is that the loan, they had a £12 million loan, now 14.8 including interest, that became due at the end of July, and they couldn't. They didn't have, because they hadn't yet, they weren't yet commercialized. They were still in sort of R&D mode.
Yeah.
They didn't have 14 million to pay back this loan, which they had to do by the end of July. And getting in any more investment proved impossible, because anyone they went to said, will you invest in us? We're great. We're the future. And by the way, the first thing we want is we're going to have to shell out 15 million at the end of July to the other person who lent us money.
Yes.
anyone who watches Dragon's Den can hear everyone go, I'm out.
Yes, exactly. Yes, precisely. Yeah, that is the problem. I suppose in a way they've painted themselves into a corner, but it's, I'm just looking at the news story that you posted. I think I thought they'd done full-scale trials, but they'd just secured a grant for demonstration projects at the Global Centre for Rail Excellence in Wales. So maybe the full-scale trials hadn't taken place yet. But maybe it was just an idea which was too far ahead of its time. I mean, it is really hard to sort of wrap your head around, really, this idea of, because we talk about AI and machine learning and drones and bots and swarm technology and all the rest of it, it still feels far too futuristic, really, to be a practical proposition.
You say that, but if they had a £12 million loan, which they thought was enough to get them from drawing board to commercialisation, and then COVID happens, and then the economy tanks, and Russia, Ukraine, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
You know, you've lost 2 years there immediately of anything you were hoping you might have got done. So maybe if they'd been given another 2 years, or if the past 2 years hadn't happened, they might have been okay. Mm. They just couldn't reach the end of the tunnel.
Yeah, maybe that's it. But maybe, I mean, if you look at the volumetric off-site manufacturing sector and you see how that has struggled to gain traction, something as wacky as hypertunnel, is far less likely to succeed, isn't it? I mean, we've talked about Ilka Holmes, Top Hat, people like that, and they've had lots of money from the government, but still couldn't make it work. And Top Hat is still going. Yeah,
I mean, they've shut their mothballed their new factory, but they've not gone yet. There's one other thing that caught your interest this week, wasn't there, David? This court ruling.
Yes, indeed. This is a story which One of the parties, it was a court battle, one of the parties of which was very, obviously he wasn't going to let go. He was like a dog with a bone. He contacted us back in about this time last year, I think it was actually. The chap, his name, just bear with me, Darren Tancred, managing director of a building services company called Providence Building Services. Was in dispute with a client, which was a social housing landlord called Hexagon Housing Association, and this is again one of these scenarios which really shouldn't happen these days, because we're supposed to be enlightened, and we're all supposed to be rethinking construction and building the team and whatever the other phrases are, and working together and partnering and, you know, having open book accounting. But here was a contractor whose client was blatantly abusing the payment system by literally not paying on time, going over the payment deadlines time and time again. I think more than 20 times, 21 payments were past their last payment date. This caused massive, as you might expect, massive cash flow problems for Tancred's business, Providence Building Services.
It's only a small outfit, Providence. It's not got deep pockets at all.
Not at all. What I hadn't realised the first time round, and Darren Tancred has made this clear in his latest bulletin to us, is that Hexagon Housing Association had actually amended the JCT contract, which they had with Providence, in order to double their payment time. So they gave themselves twice as much time to pay as the standard contract allowed, and then didn't bother to pay on time anyway. So in the end, after the umpteenth payment came in late, Darren Tancred said, "Right, this is it. I can't work like this," and walked off site. Whereupon Hexagon Housing Association took him to court for repudiating the contract, basically saying you're not allowed to walk off the project. And anyway, now did it go to adjudication? I'm trying to remember.
There's initial hearing. The first time we reported it was November last
year. That's right. Yes,
when the Technology Construction Court found in favour of Hexagon.
That's right. So it didn't go to adjudication. Yeah. It must have gone straight to the court. Yeah, which I think a lot of people would say was wrong, and I think morally it certainly was wrong, because I mean that's definitely payment abuse. If you're going to pay late every single payment, then you're going to create problems for your supply chain, which is really stupid. It's shooting yourself in the foot anyway. But the thing was, I think that the court looked at the facts, and they found out that in actual fact, Darren Tancred, or his company at least, had failed to actually follow the provisions of the contract. They weren't allowed to walk off site, because they had to basically earn the right to walk off site. And that meant that if the payment was late, they then had to put the client on notice. And if the client still didn't pay after that time, then they had basically acquired the right to cease the contract, you know, walk out, you know, leave the contract. But the thing was that Hexagon did pay up literally at the 11th hour on every occasion. So before Providence had accrued the right to walk off site, Hexagon jumped in, paid the bill, and went back to square one. And it all happened all over again. This happened 21 times. So morally, yes, I think everybody would agree that the Providence was perfectly entitled to walk away, because they'd been treated appallingly by this client. But according to the terms of the contract, they were in repudiation of the contract, and therefore the court said it had to find in favour of Hexagon. Well, I think the court also said that Darren Tancred couldn't appeal, but it went backwards and forwards, and it finally ended up. So yeah, it did go to appeal eventually, and they finally decided that Providence was in the right, and it was allowed to walk off the job. And I think a lot of people would applaud that, because although you could say that Hexagon won in the court of first instance on a technicality, basically, that everything about this stank, the way they treated their supply chain was wrong, but they had, you know, a technicality on which they could wriggle out of it. And the appeal court decided that, no, that wasn't good enough. That didn't justify punishing Providence Building Services. And so they reversed that decision and Providence won. And Darren Tancred he's a very outspoken person, and sent us a long description. And it's fair to say, I suppose, that actually we have only heard from one party to this dispute. Hexagon has been very, very quiet. We haven't heard a word from them. But I don't know what they would say in order to defend their position. They were trying it on, basically, and they got it through the TCC, the Technology and Construction Court, and probably thought they'd got away with it. But I'm very glad to say that the appeal court judges disagreed.
Yes, I think it's a happy ending for contractors out there.
Yeah.
And one in the eye for clients with long arms and deep pockets.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, wrong way around. Short arms and deep pockets.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it does raise that. This is the sort of thing that lawyers love to argue about, and I haven't heard from any lawyers about this particular case. You know, whether or not the technicality is the fact that technically Providence was wrong to walk off site according to the provisions of the contract, whether or not that trumps the moral question, or whether or not it's enough to say that the moral question doesn't really apply. But I think most people would say that you have to disagree with that sort of decision.
Morality and law, of course, are not always the same thing.
No.
Hexagon's lawyers had said last year, the case is a salient reminder to trigger happy right. contractors that jumping the gun during the termination process will have significant consequences.
Yeah.
Which just adds to the threatening tone
yeah, exactly.
of the client,
yeah.
doesn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, you could extend the firearms metaphor to say that the client was holding a gun to the contractor's head.
Yes.
So, no, a triumph for contractors, I think.
Right. Anything else we should be talking about, David?
I've run out of puff, actually. So I think that's about it, actually. I'm having difficulty stringing a sentence together now.
Good. Well, not only is it 50 days of Starmer, can you believe 20 years of Google this week?
Really?
Google's 20th anniversary. Whatever did we do before it?
God knows.
Went to the library. Or argued.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's an interesting fact. Wow.
Right. Okay. On that note, everyone, thank you again for listening. You can get in touch with us at the usual place, podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. You can also read more about some of the things we've been talking about at the Construction Index website. Get in touch. We love hearing from you. But from David and I, we'll be back again, all being well, in... Oh, yes. We can tell you what we're going to talk about in 2 weeks' time.
Oh, yeah.
In 2 weeks' time will be the publication of the final report of the Grenfell Tower inquiry, the Grenfell Tower fire inquiry. So that will be super interesting. We're going to come a day late next time because it actually is, I think it's been published on the Wednesday and the whatever that is of September. And David and I will meet up on Thursday to compare our speed reading abilities and what we've got out of that report. So all being well, we'll see you then.
All right.
Cheerio.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.